This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. My guests this week, Idlewild frontman Roddy Woomble and rising blues guitarist Danny Bryant. Idlewild formed in Edinburgh at the tail end of 1995 and played their first gig in January 96. This year they are marking their 25th anniversary, slightly late, of a short UK tour and a first ever vinyl release of their fourth album, Warnings Promises. That album is an interesting one in the band's catalogue. The band's first three records had this real noisy, punky edge to them, although Roddy's gift for melody and striking poetic lyrics was evident early on. Those elements have been fused perfectly on their brilliant third album, The Remote Part, the band's most commercially successful record. They chose a softer approach for Warnings Promises, much more in debt to American college rock like REM. I can imagine it was somewhat alienating for some of the fans who were drawn to the more chaotic elements of the band's early records. I think it's a lovely album, and perhaps it was the album that ultimately allowed them to keep going. In a way, it signalled that they were a band willing to progress and change. I was very happy Roddy was willing to talk to me for the show. We discussed the things that fed into this metamorphosis, Roddy's approach to writing lyrics, and what it's like to be the support act on a huge tour, something Idlewild have had a lot of experience in, having toured with the likes of Coldplay, Pearl Jam and REM. I hope you enjoy our chat. Yeah, you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Can you hear me all right?
I can, yeah. Are you out in the Hebrides?
No, I'm in Glasgow today, actually, because, I was doing something at the weekend at the Edinburgh Poetry Festival. I was doing something about George Mackay Brown, who's my favourite writer. It's a centenary year, so I was involved in that. So I'm down in the mainland, but I'm actually up to the Orkney Islands tomorrow.
Do you live on the Hebrides?
I live in the Isle of Iona in the Hebrides, yeah.
Have you heard The Dark Island, BBC radio drama?
No.
BBC have been repeating it at the moment. It's on the BBC Sounds app at the moment. It's the main thing I associate with the Hebrides because it's set on the Outer Hebrides. It's sort of like an old 60s kind of espionage drama, like written by Robert Barr. I think there was like a TV series which has been lost, but the radio series was broadcast in like 69. And it's one of my favourite kind of BBC radio dramas. Yeah, it's really kind of atmospheric. It's really sort of evocative of the sort of landscape and the isolation, but it has that kind of intrigue and unusual stuff happening on the island and things. It's really great.
Cool.
So I guess the main thing we talk about is 25 years of Idlewild and you're touring. I read that you're trying to involve old members as well from a band in the tour. Is that true?
Yeah. We kind of got the idea about 5 years ago. We did a couple of concerts to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the album The Remote Part. And it was originally suggested by our promoter in Scotland. And I've always been quite wary of these kind of gigs, you know, when you just play an album and all that kind of stuff. But we did it, and it was wonderful how we reconnected, not only with each other, because we hadn't been really playing that much in the year leading up to those gigs. And we were sort of making a record, but it wasn't really, it was kind of going in sort of stops and starts. So those concerts really reconnected us, not only to ourselves as a band, but also to the crowd, and we realised how much they loved that record. And at that concert, we also got Bob Fairfield involved. He was our bass player on that record. And also Alan Stewart, who was playing guitar for a number of years with Idlewild. And they came back for those gigs, and those gigs were a real catalyst for change in the band almost. It spurred us on to finish our album Interview Music. And it made us totally open to the idea of celebrating the music that we'd made together. So when it came to doing something for the 25th anniversary, we definitely thought, oh, let's do a tour, short tour, not a big long tour, and let's try and involve everyone that's been in the band, really for the crowd as well as for us, that idea of it's a musical journey I'd well have been on over sort of the quarter of a century, and all the different people that have come into it and left it and come back into it. That's really important to the story of the not only the story of the band but also the songs. So yeah, that's the idea. I mean, obviously everything got put back a year to this year now, so it's actually the 26th anniversary of the band. But and this the fallout from that was Phil Scanlon, who was the very first bass player in Idlewild, who we made our first single with. He lives in America now. He was going to fly over and play, but because of all the stuff now, he can't do that. So that's the only fallout. But otherwise, I think everyone's going to be there. Not for the whole tour, just for the Edinburgh gig.
How different do you feel from the version of yourself that firstly made the remote part? I guess it's a pivotal moment, isn't it? Like remote part, and then the guy that started the band. Do you feel connected to those versions of yourself? Or because you're talking about the remote part being, it was being surprising to sort of how you felt about revisiting that. Did you feel like quite detached from that part of your life then?
No, not detached in a way that I just mean that what I think, what interests me as a band, being in a band for a long period of time, is the collective body of work. So you're describing yourself through recordings at a different moment in your life, and if you're doing it, if you're working collectively, that makes it even more interesting because it's not just one person saying this is me. It's a group of people saying this is us. So I always think that the album shows focus too much on one aspect of the band and not bring don't bring into the whole story of why. Because the remote part sounds like the remote part because of the records that preceded it, like Broken Windows, and we're all working up to that. Similarly, then Warnings and Promises followed on. It's, as I say before, it is kind of a musical journey. So that was the only reason I'm not down on playing album shows now, having done it quite a few times, but what I'm trying to say is, I think that what makes bands interesting is the diversity of all the records. So focusing on one is never, I don't think, that healthy. But at the same time, for one night, it's a lot of fun for. And every time I go back to those songs, but we're even if it's remote part songs or earlier, like Hope Is Important, you become that person who made them the moment you're playing them, and that's what's so cool about it. That's why a lot of musicians don't age as quickly as other lines of work, because they're constantly going back to being, teenagers, or going back to their 20s by performing songs. Let's look at the Rolling Stones. Every time they play Jumpin' Jack Flash, they're like kids again almost, and that keeps them young, I think.
Yeah, I think I first saw you with Remote Part. I think I saw like a Virgin Megastore in-store thing you did,
Oh yeah.
and then I saw the Astoria show,
Oh wow.
which was fantastic.
Was a big venue.
Yeah, well, it was. I mean, yeah, it was. Yeah, it had its own vibe, didn't it? It's
Yeah.
sad when you walk down Charing Cross Road and it's not there. You're reissuing Warnings Promises on vinyl for the first time. I really like that album. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful record. But I get the impression that there's maybe like a portion of your fan base that were drawn to the more kind of punk rock elements of a band. That it must have been a tipping point, I guess, in your fan base, that record. Like Remote Part kind of still hangs on to some of the kind of early like
Yeah.
ethos, but that was more of a jump, wasn't it? You could have gone either from Remote Part, you could have gone either way from there, but you chose for that record to go a certain way.
I guess it was because Dave Ehringer produced 100 Broken Windows,
Yeah.
and he had a lot of a really big part to play in the way that how the band sort of tightened up and became a band that was able to make the remote part. He made us see what we were good at, and also saw that what people liked about Idlewild was the fact that we were basically a pretty ramshackle punk rock band, full of energy, but lots of ideas. And his sort of genius as a producer was able to kind of get that and mix it with this, because he saw the real talent that we had as melodicists and me as lyricists and things like, how can we get all that together? And he managed it with Broken Windows, and that's why Broken Windows became such a popular art record for us. So it was at that point, because Dave was producing the remote part too, after kind of a failed session with Stephen Street, Parlophone, who was our record label, but it was in the studio with Stephen Street, who obviously had hits with Blur and the Smiths. And
yeah, he's been on a pod, Stephen Street. Yeah.
Oh, he's a great guy, but it didn't really work out for us at that time. So we got to work with Dave again, which is originally what we all wanted to do anyway. And so I remember sitting down thinking with Dave as we started recording, right, like saying, right, what do we do? Because we want to make a record that's better than Broken Windows if we can. We want to make a record that is more popular than Broken Windows if we can, because we're on a major label and that's what they expect. But also, that's what we think we're capable of. We thought we're like, you know, we realize now that we're a really good band. So it was always with the intention of making a more, you know, popular record that we approached the remote part. It was definitely like, but at the same time, Dave understood how to make that record appealing to all the fans we already had. And it was to include songs like, you know, I Am What I Am Not and A Modern Way of Letting Go. Yeah, focusing on that, as well as the stuff like I Live in a Hiding Place and I Never Wanted, and songs that could definitely be more palatable to sort of Radio 2 and that kind of world. So it was a really good balancing record, and it was very brash sounding and, you know, radio friendly. But I do think that all the Idlewild fans still thought, wow, this is cool, because they're popular and they haven't really compromised, because you're still getting Modern Way of Letting Go, which is probably the most rocking song that we'd ever recorded on this record, full of other sort of pop songs. So obviously that was a commercial success for us, and it took us to a place that we didn't expect to be in. And then it was, right, make a follow-up to that. And that was when we thought, right, okay, now what? And Parlophone didn't want us to work with Dave again. They said you should use a new producer. And that's when we sort of hooked up with Tony Hoffer, who was an American producer based in Los Angeles. And we went over there and we had a totally different approach. And that's why the record sounds, you know, completely different to the remote part, because it was from the very off, it was never going to sound like that. We always knew we had to do something different. And we couldn't just carry on with this kind of, we needed to kind of focus on a different sound. And what came natural to it was the fact that we did a lineup change. Bob Fairfield had left the band during the remote part. Gavin Fox had joined us on the bass. And Alan Stewart, who'd been touring with us for the several years before that, joined us as a full-time member. So suddenly it was a five-piece band with two new members. And we wanted to include everyone in the band, as we've always done. Everyone's always been sort of split equally. So it was suddenly a five-piece songwriting unit. And it couldn't sound anything like what we'd done before, because it was essentially kind of a different band. So we really focused on that, making it as different as possible. And that's how Borders and Promises ended up sounding a lot different to the records that came before. And because of that, fans of Hope is Important just didn't want anything to do with it, understandably. I mean, by that point, there was 6 years between those records, 7 years. So everyone grows up in 7 years, don't you? So, and you find new bands and new music. I wasn't under any impression that we were going to keep the same fans all the time. But four fans disappear and new ones, come. And we've got a lot of different people come to see Idlewild from Warnings and Promises.
I mean, I think it's a great record, but, you know, I love Broken Windows and A Remote Part is probably my favourite, but yeah, Warnings is a great record. Are you happy with a record in hindsight?
Yeah. I mean, I don't tend to go back to too many of our records unless I'm choosing songs to play at a gig or whatever. Occasionally I have nights to myself when I listen to records, Idlewild records, and I always love them. You know, I really, I'm a big fan of our band. it's so intertwined with me in the memories and the ideas of when we were, when we made it, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I love it. I think dipping into full on nostalgia, diving in the deep end every so often is really good for sort of the soul. You know, you understand, you know, you realize that I have done something of worth that means something to people. Because so often creatively, you're just thinking like everything you do is terrible. You know, it's not just me, it's loads of people I know that, writers or painters, whatever, they're just, you know, racked with self-doubt constantly. So sometimes it is really nice to sort of appreciate yourself. But like I put on Warnings and Promises because I had to, it was getting mastered for vinyl.
Yeah.
So I had to listen to it all a few times. And yeah, I love it. It really holds together as a record. It has loads of great memories for me of being in Los Angeles and recording it and the sunsets and, you know, driving to Sunset Boulevard, listening to rough takes of, you know, rough of each song. And yeah, it's very evocative to me. I think that there's some words, song words that I find a bit cringeworthy now, or there's melodies I wish we'd kind of worked on a bit more. But as a body of work, it really describes us well at that point. And what we were trying to do, we were listening to a lot of Badfinger and Fleetwood Mac and The Byrds and Crosby, Stills and Nash, and all those influences really come through with the record we made.
I saw, I think it was the album launch show for that, which was also Virgin Megastores. I think you did kind of like a full band set there. I remember shouting for you to play Blame It on Obvious Ways, but you said it was like too intense for a record store or something.
Yeah, I mean, our records have always been played live, generally before we recorded the songs or we've, you know, that was one record that was our first sort of studio album in that way, that a lot of the songs were really constructed in the studio properly, you know, because a lot of them were originally just acoustic songs, acoustic demos and things. So a lot of them we've never played live, a lot of the songs in that record, which is unusual because most songs in our records have been played live.
I get the impression that Parlophone were kind of hard to please, that like the relationship you had with them was like somewhat difficult. I guess it must be mixed, because they obviously gave you like lots of opportunities as well. It got you to, you know, it's a record deal. It's better than playing to no one, I guess. It must have opened up lots of doors. But equally, it seems like it was, you know, frustrating at times as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, there was a lot of pressure on us because, you know, Parlophone is a major label, and our label mates were Kylie Minogue, Radiohead, and Coldplay, and Blur. You know, so we were at the bottom of that pile. You know, like, so we were always, from the off, we were underachievers, you know. So, and originally we signed to Food Records, which was, again, EMI, and Food was basically Blur's label. Yeah. Blur were the only band on it. But Food sort of folded, well, it didn't fold. It just, the guy that was in charge of Food got rid of the imprint, and all the bands from Food went on to Parlophone. So that happened around the time of Broken Windows. So Hope is Important and Broken Windows is on Food, but Under Broken Windows is on Parlophone, and we're on Parlophone from then on. Essentially, it's the same thing though, EMI.
Yeah.
But when we found ourselves on Parlophone, on Food it was just Idlewild and Blur, and they had an office in Camden, and it was very kind of like we'd go to the good mixer and drink, and it was all very kind of nice, and not, you didn't see the sort of the, you know, it felt quite like an indie label, even though it wasn't. Suddenly on Parlophone, it's not an indie label, you're on a major label, their offices are in Brook Green in London, it's a bit more sort of corporate, everything seems to be a bit more scrutinized. All very nice people that we worked with, and some of them I still know and get on well with. But yeah, we were kind of like, we were had to make, they were, you know, they were only interested in bands that were going to be successful. They weren't interested in having like, you know, a band on the roster that just got, you know, good reviews. They wanted their bands to sell copies of. So yeah, from and off, we were, you know, underachieving. So even though we were going into the top 10 and our records were selling a lot of copies, what you would nowadays, if you got the sales that we had then, you'd be, yeah, but now then it was like, it's only done 60,000 kind of thing. but it's all relative to what they were spending on it, because they were really investing in the band. And like you say, they offered us loads of opportunities to record with people like Stephen Street and Tony Hoffer, and to, you know, to go to Los Angeles and to tour all over the world. And so we were certainly not being ungrateful, and still am. And the opportunities that they offered us were, you know, sort of life-changing, really. So, well, yeah. It was always fraught in a way that we always felt that we were like, but never, you know, just hadn't, we'd been a little bit of a disappointment, I suppose, you know. Not like that, no one at Parlophone ever said that to us. And we got nothing but positivity about the records we were making. Mm. But it was very clear after Warnings and Promises that we, because we signed for four albums, and it was very clear after that that was going to be it. We weren't going to be re-signed for, you know, they'd fulfilled our contract We'd recorded four albums for EMI. They'd promoted them and done what they could, and the band had got to a certain point, but EMI were like, no, it's we're not going to, which was, you know, we understood that and we expected it after Warners and Promises didn't sell as many copies as was expected. And that's sort of really kind of tied in with the way the music industry was going then. You know, Spotify was set up in 2006, the year after Warners and Promises. Already, like, you know, downloading records was becoming an issue for a lot of, you know, acts signed to labels. And the music industry didn't know how to deal with that at the time. So it was like, it was almost like sort of panic stations. And very shortly after we left EMI, a lot of the people that we worked with lost their jobs or ended up working, you know. It started to kind of like, so we just kind of got out of time, I suppose. We would have, you know, even if they'd signed us for another record, and it would have, things would have been quite different. So, you know, after Warners and Promises, we sort of took ownership of ourselves. And ever since then, we've kind of either, we did license our albums to our labels, but largely now we just do it ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
Like so many acts do. Yeah. You don't really need middleman anymore, really.
No, if you've got an existing fan base to work with, and I don't know if you know much about Marillion and like what they've done with crowdfunding and whatever. And I've noticed you've used similar devices before, having your name in the booklet and things like that. And so when you've got an existing fan base, you can.
I think there's a period. It's still morphing and changing now, isn't it? And there was a period when that was like seen as a bit sort of radical and change. You know, like we did it in 2008 with Post Electric Blues.
Yeah.
And it was seen as a bit risky and stuff. But nowadays, it's totally normal to do that kind of thing. You know.
Yeah.
We tend to work on a basis now. You know, with Idlewild Records, we just always put money aside from shows and things like that, and then we have, you know, money to record and. And then we put the records out and they sort of pay for themselves and, you know, it allows us to tour. And it's like, it's almost like a little cottage industry.
Yeah.
And it really helps now that Rod Jones, the guitar player in Idlewild, he runs a studio in Edinburgh. So we just record everything there. So it's very, very cost effective too.
Yeah. In terms of, you're saying about underachieving and these things, like the opportunities you had, I wondered, because on paper, like you toured arenas like with Coldplay, I saw you support Pearl Jam at Wembley Arena. Like you played with U2. I was watching you live on Letterman on YouTube last night, and you got played on Radio 1. What things make a big difference?
Well, again, it just depends. Like I feel like I'm a wee bit outdated now in that way that I don't really know. You know, I don't know what it would be like to be sort of 18, 17, 18, forming a band and how you'd go about it now. Certainly my experience, before we got signed to a record label, we played live a lot. So we were just a live band and we didn't know how to record. You know, nowadays you can record really good sounding recordings on your little laptop, you know, with a couple of mics or whatever. But for us, it was like, we played for like a good year and a half before we even made a recording of ourselves. So that makes a difference, is playing gigs, like, because it makes you understand your capabilities, your strengths. It makes you enjoy what you're doing or not enjoy it and realize that you're doing the wrong thing. So it's a really great way of understanding yourself on a stage. You know, and I'm not a performer as such that I'd rather not be on a stage. I'm an introvert, you know, but I love being part of a band, play music. So, and then when we actually started putting records out, although playing live has always been the main thing for me, and that's the main source of income, and that's always the way that you understand how your record's doing still to this day. I think radio is the main thing that I know. When you got played on the radio, lots and lots of people knew your songs, heard the name of the band. It seemed to be a very powerful medium in that way. I've never been on TV much. We've done a few things, like, as you said, Letterman in America, and we did Jules Holland once, and Top of the Pops a couple of times. But largely, we've never really been on TV as a band. So it's been radio. And, you know, we were heavily supported by Radio 1 around the time of Remote Park. And then Radio 2 is around Warnings and Promises. And then Six Music for many years as well. We're kind of right at the start of Six Music. I think we did one of the first live gigs in 2002 when they begun. And through all those radio stations and support, and BBC Scotland as well, Radio Scotland have played us a lot. That's how I've noticed that there's a consistent interest in the band and the music. Obviously, we don't get played as much these days because we're an older band and there's so many new bands to take priority. But I noticed the impact radio had on just public knowledge of your band and ticket sales and everything like that. It's a really way, a powerful medium. So that, other than playing live, I would say, in my musical career, that's the thing.
Because obviously, when you're like a, you know, failed musician or whatever, and you think, to be able to support U2 or Coldplay or something, you think that'd be amazing. But is the reality of that actually that it doesn't really make a great deal of difference to the size of your fan base? The other factor is my wife saw you on the Coldplay tour. She must have been about 14 at the time, I think, and I mean, speaking to her and her dad, and they were like, the sound was terrible. And I mean, I guess I saw you as a support act as well in an arena. It was like Pearl Jam. I think I was literally back row of the arena, yeah. You know, and like it was okay, but like compared to seeing you headline at the Astoria or something, it was.
Yeah. It's difficult to be a support band because you're playing to people that are not really there to see you. Yeah. They're there to see the main band. So like you're always playing to sort of half to three quarters audience. Everyone's coming in, so they're just getting ready for a night of live music. Generally speaking, support band's volume's not as loud as the main band. So like, you know, so the main band can make more of an impact, or there's no lights or stuff like that, like the main band have. So you're up against it a lot in a lot of ways. So yeah, although you on paper you're getting to play to say like thousands of people, and you get to almost like someone else's fan base you're getting to play in front of. Yeah, and I'm sure there are lots of people that have heard of Idlewild through, because we toured with Pearl Jam in America as well, through Pearl Jam or through REM or U2 and Coldplay. I'm not saying, and we did a lot of touring in Europe with Placebo, who are very popular there.
Yeah,
I remember recommending this time. So there's probably a lot of people that have heard of Idlewild through those experiences. So I think it just brings awareness to your name more. As an actual experience, it can be quite soul-destroying because you're playing for half an hour. Bear in mind, you're on tour, so you're away from home, you're on tour. You're playing for half an hour a night, largely to people that aren't really that bothered.
Yeah.
And if you're on tour for 2 months doing that, like we were with Coldplay, it can start to really affect you in terms of your thinking, you know. So you're almost thinking, I'd much rather just be playing to a club full of people that wanted to see us rather than to 10,000 people that are yawning. You know, waiting for Coldplay and their light show and stuff. So, you know, I have had some great times support, like when we supported Pearl Jam around America. That was wonderful because they're wonderful people, big outdoor arenas, and it was the summer. It was great. Similarly with REM, they were one of my favorite bands growing up. It was just great to meet them and hang out and see their show and be part of that show. So I've had some wonderful experiences supporting bands. But yeah, I would say that it's not been that in terms of like, you don't come away from a tour thinking suddenly now you're going to play the arenas yourself. It's very much, you know, you might have gained some fans, but largely it's like, yeah.
Yeah, I guess if you like the band, like, you know, REM, who sort of, you know, the set list could change, you know, they mix up a set list, and so you're getting to see the show every night, and that's, you know, if you love a band, it's exciting. You know, I guess Pearl Jam, again, the set list is a wild card every night, so if you sort of want to see the act as well and you feel part of it, that must be... Yeah, that must be great.
Yeah, it's cool. It's you know, on that level, it's just really fun because you're being invited on this tour. They're always like big tours like that are always catered. So you've got nice food, got a nice dressing room. And you can basically, you're playing for half an hour a night and you're, you know, getting to hang out and watch cool bands. So there's lots of things that are really positive about it. But, you know, like if it's, you know, obviously you still got to tour and travel, and we were always generally in a bus because we had a label that would support us in that way. But still, a lot of traveling for half an hour of playing.
Yeah. Has your approach to lyric writing changed in much in 25 years?
No, actually, my approach hasn't changed. In fact, I was just working on some words there before you called. It's my notebook, and I've been very much the same all through my life. I've always had a notebook pad. I've always just used a pencil or a pen, and I've just constantly written down observations and then sort of rearranged them and they've ended up in songs, and that's what I've been doing for like what 25, 26 years now, whether it's with Idlewild or my own records. So yeah, no, my approach hasn't really changed at all. I'm not really interested in writing songs about specific things. I've never done that. I've never really thought like I'm going to write about this day, or I'm going to write about that relationship, or I'm going to write about that place. I've never done that. My lyrics are always more sort of suggestions and ideas, and the music largely gives them their meaning. So that's kind of the way I work.
There is a certain quality to your lyrics. Your lyrics have an identity, and whether it's like you play with like adverbs of frequency, you know, you'll be like, not just sometimes but always, or you'll use like almost like contradictions in terms, or
yeah.
Do you have particular techniques you use or that you did use to develop that lyrical identity?
No, I tend to think that I'm a big believer in not knowing what you're doing. I think that when it comes to creative, obviously not if you're a doctor or a lawyer, but I think creatively, I think it's really valuable. The idea of like, I hate it when people say, I've been asked a few things over the years of teaching songwriting. And I've done one once, and I left thinking like the people that were wanting to be taught could probably teach me more. It's like, it's one of these things, I don't want to know how you do it. Like, and I don't want to be taught. I want to like be trying to figure out how it works. And that's anyone that I've spoken to, friends or people I've met who are working as poets or painters or sculptors, they have a similar attitude. It's like, it's the minute you think, I know what I'm doing, and this is, then it's kind of, your work has maybe lost its appeal. And I don't like it when you hear songwriters talk about their craft and talk about this and offering advice. It's like, I don't believe them. You know, I don't think that, I think it's there's a real mystery to it, and I live within that mystery. Like, you know, I like the fact that every time I try and do it, and I say try and do it because it's the way I feel. You know, I'm trying to figure it out, like how it works, how my words will work with melodies, and they always kind of end up or they don't. Songs just, there's so many songs that just don't work, but. See, I don't really play a musical instrument. I mean, I do play a bit of guitar, and I can compose basic stuff on guitar. But largely, I always work with people, and that makes a difference too, because you're always bouncing ideas off someone. I think that's quite healthy.
How much do you think visually with music? Have you got? Do you tend to like have a lot of mental images in your mind when you're, I guess, when you're writing lyrics or when you're performing? Have you got quite a visual kind of imagination in connection to music?
Yeah, I suppose I do. I mean, I love visual art. I love painting, and I paint myself as a hobby. And I do love, the stimulus of colour, like, you know, like abstract expressionist painting especially. I suppose when I do paintings, I do think of them in the way that I think of words, some words, which is like putting why two colors put together make you feel a certain way. You can't really explain that. Similarly, as when two chords put together make you feel a certain way, or two words, or so. I suppose there's an element of when I'm writing words, I'm sort of making patterns with words a wee bit, you know, if that makes any sense. I'm using it more as compositionally, quite artistically, I suppose, not thinking about, I need to write a song that describes my journey from Dundee to Glasgow and then how I felt when I got there, you know. So I'm not on that page at all, and as a songwriter. And then it's almost like chiseling away at something. And then, so when you've got an initial structure for the words, you can start actually getting rid of some words and adding other ones. And then suddenly something, you know, resembling a song or song words, verse chorus structure comes out. And then, you know, it's always the difficult thing with any kind of, for any form of art or anything you're working on, is knowing when to leave it, knowing when to abandon it, you know, and move on to the next thing. That's the thing I struggle with, because that's sometimes when I listen to words, I think I worked on that too much. And there's some songs on Warnings and Promises, actually, I think like that. I think that's too labored over. I should have like left. You know, because I can find probably in my old notebook, I can find the original version thinking I should have left it at that, rather than thinking I needed to, you know, make it feel more poetic, or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, so it's, yeah, it's a fascinating process for anyone, I think, from coming from having no idea, and then suddenly the idea presents itself and it becomes something fully formed that you mean you can listen to, someone in Japan can listen to. It's cool.
As you're writing the words, are you writing the vocal melody, or are you trying to... So you go in with a vocal melody which the band then have to write around?
That depends. Sometimes not, sometimes yeah. But I always do the melodies in all the songs that we've done, and all the words.
I guess sometimes they're giving you music which you're then writing to.
Yeah, like sometimes I'll come up with a melody for a song that's very, very good. I don't mean that in a big-headed way.
No.
Which will then therefore make Rod or whoever I'm working with change what they're doing musically. And they'll go with more with that melody. World in Your Arms is probably a good example of that. That was very much based on that melody that I came up with. You know, that one, and Rod was playing on his guitar. And that became the string section, which is a real hook of the song, which goes right to the song. And then my melody kind of wove in and out of that. But so, yeah, I suppose, like, I've got, some sort of knack for coming up with catchy melodies. And I'm lucky to work with people that are good musicians that can kind of, we can work them into good songs.
I guess one of the reasons I asked about the visual thing is I think I read that you said you're a big cinema fan and you discovered sort of, you know, Boot de Souffle, the, you know, Jean-Luc Godard film, and that had like a big impact on you. And I just wondered how that, those sorts of things fed into what you do and your medium.
Well, one thing I love about all those French New Wave directors like Agnès Varda and Eric Rohmer and Jean-Luc Godard is they look upon life in a sort of realistic fashion, you know. And the way that, like, quite often, like, you know, Godard does a lot when he films dialogue, he's quite behind the person, so it's some behind someone's head, you know. But that's the way you kind of look at life, isn't it? You don't, like, you're not always looking at these perfectly filmed things when you're, like, going your day-to-day life. So they're really great observational artists, all of those French New Wave directors, I think. All their stories are cool, and obviously they cast, like, really amazing actresses and actors, and stylistically their clothes and all these things that still have the appeal now nowadays. But it's just the way they told stories was so, like, non-linear. And interesting, and that's definitely had an influence on the way I approach my own artistic work. Is that that's how it's, and the dialogue they use is the way that people speak. People don't speak like Hollywood scripts. They speak like, you know, much more like, there's lots of pauses and awkward things when you're thinking about things, and that's all in New Wave films. It's a new way of, I guess it was a new wave of explaining cinema, which was still kind of an art form that was finding its feet. I'm very fascinated, but when I was a film student, I was in film school for like 2 years and dropped out. So it's a real passion of mine, watching. But then I can't deal with Hollywood films. And I get accused by all my pals of being like a real sort of cinema snob, you know, like I won't watch a James Bond film or something like that. But I mean, I don't like that. Life's too short for bad art. Now, I'm not saying James Bond is bad art, but it doesn't appeal to me on any level. So when it comes to cinema, I'm definitely, yeah, European films are my favourite in that way, just because the way they describe life, is I can relate to it a wee bit, I suppose.
Well, thanks for doing the interview, mate. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
If you're enjoying the show, please leave a nice review on Apple if you can. Could you send an episode to a friend who might enjoy it? And please check out the growing back catalogue of episodes, featuring my chats with David Crosby, David Duchovny, Stevie Van Zandt, Adam Duritz, and loads more. You can find me on Twitter at Signals Podcast and on Instagram at Sending Signals Podcast. Danny Bryant is a blues guitarist and singer from Hertfordshire. Danny is an old-fashioned musician in a sense. He worked his way up the pub circuit and he plays a lot of shows. He's about to release a new album, The Rage to Survive, which you'll hear some clips from during our chat. Danny was really good company. We talk about the making of a record, how you develop a unique voice as a guitarist, and whether he ever finds it confining working within a musical form like blues. I'm by no means an expert on blues rock, so I took a bit of a layman's approach to this interview. I hope you find it interesting.
Enjoy.
How you doing? Nice to see you. Nice to meet you.
Likewise. How are you, mate?
I'm good. I, as you notice, I've hurt my head here. Other than that, I'm good.
What happened?
Do you know what? First show back in like almost 2 years, and everyone's so impatient to get off the flight. Ryanair, someone opens the baggage thing and boosts me like that. So I should, you know, I was going to tell you I was in a fight or something, but I didn't think I could make it believable. So,
being a blues artist, you could have really built mythology here.
I know, I should have done, but I just thought.
Are you home now? Are you on tour at the moment?
Yeah, no, I'm home. That the long tour doesn't start for like almost 3.5 weeks time, I think, and it's about that long. That was just a one off, but it was a good way of seeing if we could still do it, you know. And it was a good way of kind of testing the whole traveling through airports, COVID, Brexit scenario.
Where is home?
Royston in Hertfordshire. So we're like, where are you?
I'm Southend-on-Sea.
Oh, nice. So we're like, we're like 15 minutes from Cambridge and like 40 minutes on the fast train from London. So it's quite a nice place to be.
Yeah. Did you grow up in Hertfordshire?
Yeah. Yeah, I live about 2 miles from where I grew up. Yeah.
It reminds me of that kind of Springsteen thing, you know, that he was, yeah, there's always yearning to sort of get out of town, you know. There's a lot of his early career is kind of about that, but like he now lives, you know, like 2 miles from where he grew up or something, you know.
But I mean, if you live in a nice place and then you tour and travel a lot, you actually get to realize, oh, where I live's pretty nice, you know.
It's hard to see where you live through like the eyes of a tourist sometimes as well. When you grow up somewhere, you can get quite embittered, or like you get frustrated by what is wrong with where you live, you know, whether it's sort of because you see the worst side of perhaps local people, or bad things happen, or you get annoyed that the music scene isn't good enough, or that there isn't an art house cinema, or whatever it is that, like, you know,
we don't even have a music scene here,
right? So all those things can sort of frustrate you. But then sometimes if you try and look at your place, sometimes I live right near the seafront, and sometimes I walk down there on a nice day and it'll be like, if I was here as a tourist, I'd think this place was beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
And and it's like, hang on, there's loads of things here that I don't really make use of. Like a few years ago, I realized that I never really used the pier, and we've got like a huge pier here. And there are like art galleries, and there's a planetarium that I've never been to, and I made an effort to try and do things that, like, if I was a tourist, might be the things I check out and do, but that I hadn't done that were on my doorstep. And it does make a difference, I think, to a perception of your town if you can try and look at it through like fresh eyes somehow. But it's really hard to do that when you've been there so long.
No, I think it's that you're totally right, and it's totally true. And I think it, in a way, touring does allow you to do that. Because you come, you know, if you've been away a month, you come home and for about 5 minutes, you see it with new eyes. And then I'm sure you've noticed, if you have like friends or relatives come to visit, you'll maybe see it through their eyes then as well.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Congratulations on The Rage to Survive. You must be you must be really proud of it.
I am, yeah. And so far the reviews have been really good. I mean, it's not out for a week or so, but it's like I always feel when I make an album, it's like I've got away with it again, you know, because you never know if you can write another one. I always feel like that anyway. It's you know, and then you do, and it, because touring is natural, or it was until COVID, but the studio isn't. It's something you visit every 2 years or something, so you kind of have to get used to it again.
Yeah, I guess for some, the studio is their natural environment, and the craft is making an album, and then they maybe have to figure out a way to tour it. But I guess for you, you work in more of a kind of, I guess you're more at home in sort of a live band setting, and
yeah, the
physicality of playing is your thing, I guess. So yeah, that's an it's maybe the opposite of how some people feel.
Definitely. I think the thing is, Matt, with some people, you know, they can afford to spend 6 months off the road and also 6 months in the studio, so it does become like a laboratory,
yeah,
kind of environment. And I think that works. Certainly it worked in the early days for people like Springsteen, and for other acts, I think sometimes it can be detrimental. But I think that, yeah, but even looking at, you know, coming back to Springsteen again, the latest one, the Letter to You one, I think they did that in about 4 or 5 days. So people change.
Yeah, it was really quick, yeah. Did you have any kind of manifesto for this record, what you wanted to achieve?
Well, I had things that I didn't want to do. I was determined to wait until everything was legally open so we could record it kind of live as a band in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that I definitely wanted to happen. I kind of was determined not to write a lockdown record because I thought everyone will be, and everyone won't really want to be reminded of it. But of course, everything that happens in your life is going to inform what you write about. So I suppose in a way it is lyrically a bit of a lockdown album.
I think that's going to be a common thing. I heard Steve Hogarth from Marillion say that, like, yeah, I was determined not to write about COVID, yeah, and lockdown, but it's a bit inevitably it finds its way in because it's
well, it does, because you write about, and it's like, we, you know, when we met up to go in the studio, I hadn't, because my band spread throughout the country, we hadn't seen each other for like a year, and there was that weird thing of like not knowing how to socially interact with anyone.
Mm.
And we were all sort of like looking at our shoes for the first 10 minutes, and it was also like, you can't really say to someone, so what have you been up to? Oh, well, I've done my hour's walk a day and that's it. I've watched everything on Netflix, you know. So, yeah, it was a different kind of experience.
There is a degree of expansiveness to the album as well. There's like Brass on Invisible Me and Looking Good.
Yeah.
I gather, was that sort of overdubbed later, or did you record the Brass live with you, or...?
No, they were the only thing that was over. Well, obviously there's a couple of guitar overdubs and things, but they were overdubbed simply because we always do it that way logistically. I need them to hear the song, and then David, the trumpet player, writes the charts for me on that, because I have two bands. I have like a 4-piece band, you know, bass, drums, and keys, and then I have a 9-piece band, you know, which has a rhythm guitar and a 4-piece horn section, and we kind of split the touring year between the two. So, you know, maybe 50 big band shows and maybe 60 or 70 4-piece shows. So you need the album to represent both things, if that makes sense.
Was blues your thing from an early age?
It was, actually, yeah, because of my parents' record collection was a lot of like Hendrix, Rory Gallagher. But there was also that side that had like every Dylan album, every Springsteen album, you know, so there's been those two sides, really. But, you know, when I first got a guitar, I wanted to play, sorry, that's my dog making those noises. I wanted to, you know, I went for the sort of Hendrix, Rory Gallagher, Clapton thing. And then when I got older, you know, my dad would say, you know, listen to this. His big thing was Dylan, you know, and Springsteen. So, that's when I got into songwriting and listening to lyrics and melodies and things like that.
Right. So I noticed Tangled Up in Blue gets a mention in a lyric.
Yeah.
On this album, yeah.
Someone said to me, well, they said, is that your favourite Dylan song then? And I said, no. I said, but, you know, I mean, I like the stuff of like Time Out of Mind or something. I said, but when you reference a Dylan song, you've kind of got to reference one that everyone knows. Otherwise, they're going to think, what's he talking about?
Yeah, there's something about the mythology of Blood on the Tracks as well. It lends itself to being referenced, doesn't it? It's like,
and what a great album title as well.
Yeah. When you get into the history of it as well, and the sort of alternate New York versions and things, and for Record Store Day a couple of years ago, they released the original early pressing of the album that kind of got shelved because they went back and sort of went a different route with it. But so that was really cool to sort of finally get hold of.
Yeah, I've heard some of that stuff. You know, I mean, and I do love all these kind of bootleg series things that Dylan releases. I've just been listening to the latest one. I don't know what volume it is, but the kind of the outtakes from Infidels and all that.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a guy that, I mean, his albums are astonishing, but that's definitely a man that sometimes gets lost in the studio, because you listen to some of those outtakes and you think, oh, that was way better than the one that ended up on the album.
Yeah, it's frustrating that artists are not always the best curators of their own work.
Definitely not. No, I totally agree. And I sometimes wonder with Dylan, I know we're going off topic, but I sometimes wonder if he does it to spite people almost.
I think it's just like a cavalier attitude. I don't think he's invested in his own art as other people are.
I think that's a good way of putting it, actually. I'm going to steal that. I've got another one. I've got another one later. I think I'm going to say the same thing.
As I understand it, you started learning guitar at 15, and by 18 you were professional. That's a fast turnaround.
Well, the trick is not to get a girlfriend, because I couldn't get one, and to spend 10 hours a day in your room playing guitar, and then you've got no distractions, and then it started in the local pubs, and it got to sort of like, I mean, there isn't the pub scene, I don't think, now where you could do that. It's a long time since I've played in any of the pubs, but it used to be that we could go within a 50, about 40 mile radius of anywhere around here and play five nights a week.
Wow. I was going to ask what it's like getting established in the blues scene. Like, is it a welcoming scene? Is it competitive? Is it insular?
It's all of those, really. It is competitive. The people at the top tend to always be nice because they don't really have to prove anything. There is a kind of a camaraderie there because as blues musicians, we don't always get a lot of mainstream kind of attention and things like that. And so in order for us to reach our market, to sell albums, to get out there, we do have to tour a lot. So when you see someone on a festival, you realise that you've travelled like hundreds of miles, and so have they. And you have that kind of that camaraderie.
Yeah, I'm curious about how you establish an identity as a guitarist, because I think it's a challenge to do. Like with a physical voice, everyone's physical voice is unique, isn't it?
But
with an instrument, you know, you can as good as clone someone else's playing, can't you? And so trying to, and as a blues, you know, as a blues guitarist, although you've got your own voice, which is powerful and, you know, is great, but you have to have that second voice that's as important, which is your guitar playing. So what makes you distinct as a player, do you think?
In terms of how you develop it, I think what you do is you listen to all your influences, you absorb them and everything. And then eventually, if for example, you're playing like a BB King lick, and then you're going to play Eric Clapton lick, you need something to tie those two licks together. And that's the bit in the middle. And that bit in the middle becomes your identity, I think.
That's a good answer.
It's the only way I can really explain it.
Did you spend like countless hours trying to develop a tone? Like, is gear a part of it?
Not for me, massively. I'm quite rare in the fact that I just take a guitar, a lead, and an amp and plug it straight in.
Right.
So, obviously, I have a tone that I like, but I do believe, you know, it's the cliche, but it's in the fingers, good or bad. You know, if another guitarist played through my rig, they're going to sound like themselves. And then if I played through theirs, I'm going to sound like me. I'm a big believer in that.
I'm also interested in when you work within a genre that has almost these kind of set rules and kind of a form, you know, a bit like reggae in a sense, you know, there's a distinct thing that makes it reggae. Do you ever find that kind of restrictive? Like, do you feel like you have, I mean, in a way, like you're limiting your creative freedom compared to like a jazz musician or being in a prog band or whatever it is. Like, and this is what fascinates me about being working within a form. Is it just a taste thing that you like being in that form, and or do you feel that it is free? Like, I'm just curious how you wrestle with that.
No, it's a good question. It starts like that in the sense that what you just said is a taste thing. You enjoy that. And then, you know, it's up to you to kind of, you don't have to get stuck in that, you know. Like, if you listen to the new album, you know, there are not that many songs that are just like stuck in the 12 bar blues format. Mm. Obviously, as the media need to put a label on every genre of music, because otherwise how do you sell it? So we call it blues rock. But I think you can allow every influence to come in. But I also think that once you get a little bit of a kind of fan base, I think you have to be aware that you can't go off and make a country album. You know, that sometimes you've got to look at the album and think, have we got enough blues on here? You know, is this too rocky? Is this too ballady? Is it too inspired by Springsteen or Tom Waits or John Hyatt? You know, so there are those boundaries in that sense. But no, I don't find it particularly limiting. And if it's music you truly love, then you're quite happy to stick somewhat in the confines of that genre.
So you won't be making Nashville Skyline anytime soon?
Well, I might, but I won't ever release it. Well, if it was as good as Nashville Skyline, I think I'd happily release it. But I do actually play, I play Girl from the North Country actually live.
Do you?
But yeah.
Nashville Skyline's great. I really like it.
Great. It's just really weird how different his voice is on that.
I know. I read like, oh, he quit cigarettes for a few months, but I'm still not convinced that would make that much. If he's been, I don't know.
I've never smoked, but I don't think it could change it that much.
No, not. Yeah, it's bizarre. Yeah. So your kind of your dance card, for want of a better word, is getting pretty full up for the next year or so.
Yeah.
How'd you cope with that level of traveling?
You just, I don't know, it's, if you enjoy it and you love it, it's not too hard. I mean, it's you know, it's just about taking the show seriously, but the rest of the time we have a lot of laughs, you know, spend a lot of the time traveling, laughing, learning to give each other sort of space on the road as well is important. Because everyone, you know, especially when you're traveling with a big band and then a couple of crew, you know, there's always someone that's going to be having a bad day. They've had a bad phone call at home. The kid's got toothache at home or something, and the wife's missing them or something, or they're missing their wife, or, you know, so you just have to be aware of people and try and not be selfish about it, and see yourself as a whole collective.
It must be nice having in a way two bands. It must kind of break things up a bit. Like if you get, like, it must be nice to have the camaraderie of like a smaller unit and the kind of the fact that you're more mobile in a way, and it's easier to set up. But then I guess having fresh people come in must just kind of stop you getting that cabin fever of like...
It really does. In fact, the way this next tour works, well, we've got a few in England, but we don't really tour England until next March. But the way this next tour works, which will be in Holland, Germany, and Switzerland, and Austria, and Luxembourg, so it's all European, is that we start the first four shows as a four-piece, and then for like 17 shows, the big band join, and then they go home for like the last four shows. And we did the same the last time, pre-COVID, we did that. And like the last four shows felt sort of quite strange and I wouldn't say flat once we got on stage, but it was almost like suddenly it was very quiet, you know?
Yeah. Well, I hope it goes well, mate. And I hope that this album reaches a bigger audience, because
thanks, man.
No, it's a good record, man, and I hope it does well for you. And that's our show. Thanks as always to our guests whose opinions are their own. Thanks also this week to Ben Pester. I'll be back in a couple of weeks.